good evening. Good to see you back here tonight. We're going to be in the book of Genesis tonight. We're going to try and do two whole chapters plus a part of another one. So buckle up. One of the chapters happens to be the longest one in Genesis too, so we'll see. Anyways, tonight's topic and study here is kind of imagine with me a family photo album. Okay, how many of you have those at your house? Right? Or maybe you just have boxes of photos that you're someday I'm going to put those into an album, right? Or if you are younger, you might say, they're all on my phone. Now what do I do with them, right? Whatever. You have pictures. And it's fun every once in a while to go back and look through pictures and see memories and have reminders of different things, right? These chapters in Genesis, chapter 22 and 23 and part of chapter 25, really are like snapshots of the final events of Abraham and Sarah's life. Okay, so imagine with me, these are pages, collages of their photo album that describe the end of their life. And so we're going to begin tonight by seeing the death of Sarah, and we're going to end by seeing the death of Abraham and what happens and transpires in that window of time. So these are some snapshots. I want to get through all of this tonight, because I'm really intending to end our study in Genesis here. We're going through it in the Gospel Project on Sunday mornings right now in Sunday school, and so I'm going to jump ship from Genesis, and we're going to start a study in Daniel, which I think has a lot of timely things for us to think about in terms of courage and all kinds of different things. So if you're interested in Daniel, come back next week, and I think we'll start it next week. But tonight we're going to try to get through this last couple bits of Abraham's life, and it starts in chapter 23 with the death of Sarah. So if you look there in Genesis chapter 23, verses 1 and 2, Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. So Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Death is a hard thing, isn't it? It's not anything that you like to think about. I've been really worried about my dad's mom. My grandpa died 2 years ago, and it's just, you see the weight that it is upon her. They were married for almost 60 years, and when my grandpa passed, it's their whole lifetime, right? That's now been changed, and some of you have gone through that. Some of you have had very traumatic experiences that have taken your spouse from you or children or those that you love, and it's such a hard thing, especially when you've established a life and a history with them, right? And so we are brought into this text tonight on a very sobering note with Sarah's passing. This brings to end a really incredible life. You know, we have a lot of different pictures of things throughout the scriptures, but Abraham and Sarah's life is unique in that it is the longest single contemplation of a married life in the scriptures. For the past couple weeks of our study, and if we think about the time that elapses here, we have basically a 60-year look at their marriage. Right, we've seen from the time when they were called out of Ur of the Chaldees and their travels. We've seen some of Sarah's failures. We've seen some of her successes. We've seen their struggles with fertility and infertility. We've seen the joy over Isaac's birth. We've seen her devotion to her husband. We've seen her faith, and we've also seen God's faithfulness to her. It's been really quite the journey when you just stop and pan back and think about the journey that we've walked along with Abraham and Sarah, and how we've seen their highs, and how we've seen some of their lows, and some of the good things, and some of the bad things, and it all comes to an end here in this chapter in Genesis. She is often sort of maybe pushed to the side a little bit, because Abraham is the father, right? He's the father of faith, and yet she is given as an example. She's given a place in the New Testament in a couple different passages that speak about her legacy as the example of what a woman of faith looks like. We often talk about Abraham being the father of those who believe. And that's repeated in the scriptures a number of times, but Sarah is recorded in many of the same exact ways. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 11 says this: by faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. What a beautiful statement, right? I mean, I don't care if you're a man or a woman. If you had that to be your legacy, right? To say that this is your legacy, you judged God faithful to do what he promised. Isn't that quite the legacy? Right? She judged. In other words, she had doubts, she had thoughts, she had questions, she wrestled, but she weighed out everything that she knew about God, and she judged God faithful. And so what did she do? She believed. And even though she was as good as dead, essentially is how the Bible kind of portrays her, she's able to give birth to a son in her old age. Right? It's a beautiful picture of her faith because this woman, through her whole life, had been seeing the hand of God and the faithfulness of God and the promises of God. And when it all came down to the point of, do I believe that he can give me a son or do I not believe, she weighed it all out and she judged in her mind. She made a decision. She made a conscious effort to believe this. God can do what he promised. So she believed, and God gave her the son that she had longed for all of these years. She wrestled, and she weighed out her decision. No one, I remind you, would demand that we blindly receive the word of the Lord. Sometimes people say, oh, you Christians, you just believe in blind faith. No, we don't, actually. And Sarah is a wonderful example of this, where she judged. She weighed all the facts out. She weighed out God's character and what she was feeling in her heart. And she judged. She made a conscious choice to believe this to be true about God. And I don't expect any of you just to say, well, I just believe everything anyone's ever told me. I'll just accept it all and just I'll never think about it. That's not biblical faith. Biblical faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen, right? We're supposed to have some meat. We're supposed to weigh out these things and then hold them because we believe that God is truer than anything else that we can experience or know about here in this life. Sarah got to that point with the Lord, where even though she had had a rough road in many ways, and one of those chief desires of her heart, and that was to have children, even though she had messed up along the way and saying, I got an idea, let's have Hagar, she, at the end of her life, and as towards those the last few years that she was alive, both before she gave birth and then in the seems about the 37 years afterwards, that she really came to a place where she believed deeply in God. And this is why in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, she is given as the example of the matriarch of women of faith. In 1 Peter chapter 3, 1 through 6, I won't read it all for you, but it talks about how women are to really desire to have, not to adorn themselves with outward beauty, but to really adorn their heart, to have this peaceable spirit. And Sarah is an interesting example of this. Because remember, when Sarah went down to Egypt with Abraham, she was so beautiful at 65 that Abraham was worried for his life. Remember, if there was ever, like a model in the Old Testament of beauty externally, Sarah was it, right? I mean, at 65, Abraham was really scared for his life because he thought all the Egyptians are going to kill me. And so they had to make up this lie, which brought about more trouble, right? But she had all of the outward trappings. But what is recognized about her and why she's described as a woman of faith, as a woman of old, is because of the inner spirit that she contained. And her willingness to go and travel and be submissive and love and support her husband along the way. You can read that passage, beautiful words. But Sarah is given as like the example of the women of old that are examples of faith. Not perfect by any means, not married to perfect men by any means. But they show their character by their heart and what is going on in the inner spirit versus what is going on externally. And she's given as the example, the name that is mentioned there. It also says here in our text, if you come back to Genesis, that she died in Hebron, as it was called in later days. And it seems as though Abraham wasn't with her when she died. Now, it's hard to tell exactly because 2 weeks ago, we left Abraham. He was in Beersheba, and now they are in Hebron. But it's also clear that about 25 years of time has elapsed since our last study in Genesis. A huge gap of time elapses, but it seems as though Abraham was not with her because it says that she died, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. It seems as though he was apart from her, right? He had to come to her to mourn and to weep for her. Was he someplace else? Was he just not present? I don't know, but isn't this kind of a heartbreaking thing? Right? They've been together for all these years. They've been married for so long. We've seen so much of their story, and then she passes when he's not near, and he has to come into her and mourn her after the fact. It's a sobering thing that should really get to our hearts as we think about this. This results then in the one and only time that we have record of Abraham weeping in the scriptures. Of all the things that moved him to tears, the thing that moved him to tears in the story of his life was the death of his dear wife. You get a glimpse into the closeness that they shared here. One of the things I want to remind you of here, and I hear this often, I've heard it even recently, that people say, oh, I'm so sorry for crying when they're dealing with grief. Why? Why? We've somehow made it foolish if people cry. And yet, here we see in the example of scriptures of Abraham and many, many other people through the scriptures that when grievous loss comes to us, tears are a natural reaction. There's no reason that you should feel like you have to bottle them up and hide them and be strong for everybody else. This is a part of human existence. It's part of how God made you. It's right to mourn over things that are worth mourning over. And it's also a reminder that death is not supposed to be the way that this life ends. Right? Part of the reasons that we're moved to tears, part of the reasons that we're moved to such sorrow, part of the reason we're moved to such grief over the death of someone that's so near to us is because it wasn't supposed to be like that. Remember? Way back in the beginning of Genesis, I don't know how many weeks ago that was now, it was probably months, probably a bit better to measure it. But remember how we talked about that? God made everything and it was very good. No need for death, no need for separation, no need for sorrow, no need for tears, and then sin comes into the world and it wrecks everything. See, death wasn't supposed to be a part of things, but it is now because of sin, and that's part of the reason that we grieve. Although, like Paul says, we do not grieve as those who have no hope. We have our faith in God. Right? That is a grief when people die, and it should bring us to tears because it is not supposed to be this way. And it's one of the things that we must constantly fight to remember as Christians is death is not natural. Well, they died of natural causes. No! I understand what they mean, right? But death is not supposed to be the way that God intended it. Right? It is not a natural thing. It is a consequence of sin. And this is one of the glories of resurrection and the life that is to come is death will be no more. The way it was supposed to be. That's how it's supposed to be. That's why Jesus says when he comes, says, the thief comes to steal and kill and destroy, but I come to give life and life to the full. He's not only talking about spiritual life today, he's talking about the fullness of abundant life in all of everlasting life. That's what he really wanted for us in the first place. Whenever we think about death, remember the fact that there is mortality in all of us, though, because of the work of sin. There's not any of us here tonight that aren't going to die, short of the Lord coming back and taking us to himself. Right? It is the normal thing for us now, and we need to be serious about the way that we live our lives, because who knows when our life can come to an end. We need to be serious about our life. We must always be reminded that we are in need for the grace of God, but we also must remember that death is not the end of everything. Now, what happens next is that Abraham gets up from his mourning. Verse 3, very sobering statement, very direct. Abraham stood up from before his dead. It's sort of a direct statement. Right? His wife is dead. He has mourned her. And now what do you have to do? Well, now you got to go through this, you know, yucky, uncomfortable business of, well, where do we put her body now? Right? And so that is really what unfolds here in the rest of the chapter. And what happens here, and I'll summarize it for you for the sake of our study here tonight, is he goes about to seek and secure a place of burial for his wife. And you see a couple things here about Abraham and his character in all of this. First thing you see here is that Abraham had respect to those that he spoke with. Whenever he comes to these sons of Het that are mentioned there in verse 5, we see every time he comes to them that he shows respect to them. In fact, it shows in the text, if you were to read through it all, that he bows down to them on two different occasions, showing them honor, showing them respect, which to me is something quite incredible, because when a lot of times when we are faced with stress or trial or grief, we don't always respond in the best way. Right? Sometimes we get short with people, sometimes we get snippy with people, sometimes we blow up at people, and because you have so much going on, you just, right, don't always respond the way that we ought to, right? I've had that happen in people's homes after loved ones have passed. I've had it happen at funerals, and people are like, I'm so sorry, and I expect that there's going to be a range of emotions experienced. But Abraham here shows the reality of what's going on inside of his life because he shows absolute respect. He's never presumptuous, he's never short, he's never rude with these sons of Het. I would remind you, as much as is possible because of the Spirit of God in us, Christians really should be gracious mourners. We really should. Right? We should be willing to exercise and show love, not because we're strong people or because we're good people or because we're kind people, but because we are supernaturally enabled people. Who's in us? The fruit of the Spirit is what? Love and joy and peace. And that does not stop. His influence does not stop at the moment when death occurs. Right? and the death of a loved one occurs, the death of a friend occurs, right? The Spirit of God is still at work on us. It's kind of like, I've been camping with a few different groups of people, and there's always kind of a joke, you know, that when people wake up from camping in the morning, don't get anywhere near them until they get their coffee, right? Maybe that happens at your house every morning, I don't know. But is it true? It shouldn't be true, because who's in us? The Spirit of God has nothing to do with your coffee, right? And the same thing should be happening even in the most crucial moments of these, like when you have the death of the spouse. The second thing you see here, if you read through the whole text, is that he acted fairly. He ends up meeting this man named Ephron, and he wants to buy the land. And Ephron's like, no. You just take it. There's a cave in this beautiful spot, and Abraham's like, no, I really want to buy it. And he's like, no, you're grieving your dad. Just take it. And he acts fairly with him, because what he says is, okay, then tell me this. How much is the land? What's the market value, essentially, of the land right now? And the man tells him it's 400 shekels, and so Abraham says, I want to pay you the full price. He doesn't ask for any benefits. He doesn't ask for any, you know, favor. He doesn't try to slip him a bribe under the table, and he conducts this business actually in front of the elders of the city so that everybody can see that this is a fair, open practice. Again, you see the character of Abraham here. The third thing you see here is that he acted wisely. Why did Abraham buy the land when he was offered it for free? Well, the simple reason is because he doesn't belong to this land. He's a foreigner here. And forevermore now, the land will always be deeded to him and to his family because he paid for it. Right? There could always be this opportunity, there will always be this occasion down the road when people are like, yeah, Ephron gave it to him, but it was just for a short period of time. Abraham was coercive in the whole thing. Let's give the land back to who it belongs to. But Abraham, by paying the full market price, doing it in the context of everyone else, this land that he is burying his wife in will become the land that the patriarchs are all buried in, and it will be theirs for forevermore. He saw and had some foresight here to know how this may go. And so he pays the full price, and he acts wisely here. And the last thing here is that he acts in faith. He acts in faith because he believes, and the reason that he mentions in the text is that the reason that he wants this place to bury, the reason that he wants to have a burial in this spot, is because he believes that this is the land that God promised to him. He knows that he is going to abide here with his residence forever. This is the land that God said, I'm going to give your descendants after this 400 years of being away. I'm going to bring you back. This is the land. And Abraham believed that me and all my kin and all my kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, like the stars and like the sand, we're all going to live right here, and my bones are going to be in their midst. So he acts in a great amount of faith here also. And that's exactly what happens. All of the patriarchs are buried in this cave. Even the bones of Joseph were brought back and laid to rest in this cave. Now, the next thing that happens is the marriage of Isaac. So if you look over to chapter 24, this is the single longest chapter in all of Genesis, and it's almost as long as the flood account if you were to add up all the verses. So it's very, very long, and if you've read this account recently, I'm not going to read it all for you tonight. You'll find that if you read it all, it's basically it says it all once, and then it says it all a whole second time, which is part of the reason why it's so long, right? Because everything that happens and everything was thought and everything was done happens once, and then it all gets repeated so that we hear it and so that it's recited. So that's part of the reason that it is so long. But I want you to notice here, starting in verse 1, the setup for this. And I'll break this down into a couple of parts. First thing we'll see here is Abraham's plan as part of this marriage that Isaac has. Abraham was old and well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant in his house, who ruled over all that he had, and said, please put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. But you will go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, perhaps the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I take your son back to the land from which you came? Abraham said to him, beware, you do not take my son back there. The Lord God of heaven, who took me out of my father's house and from the land of my family, who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send an angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son there. And if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you are released from this oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore concerning this matter. So let's take a look first here at the plan. Abraham's really old, and what he's thinking about is the fact, I'm old, and frankly, my son is old, and I still don't have a grandson, right? So we got the first generation of this great nation being born, but what about the next generation? And Isaac is almost 40 at this point and unmarried. It seems that they are really, really slow in his family, right? They're just kind of delayed in their progression, I guess. But what we do know is that the Lord had blessed Abraham greatly, and the Lord, or Abraham, is really intending here to get his son married off. Now, a couple of things here to point out. First of all, it seems like a small thing, but it's so important that he swears this oath before the Lord, the God of heaven. Right? He wants this to be done before the Lord. Everything that is about to unfold in this love story, in this marriage account, is done before the Lord with the Lord's blessing and with the Lord being central to everything. Okay? The reason that he wants to do this is because he is acting in behalf of his son, but also in fulfillment and in keeping with the plans that God had made. God wanted him to be here. God wanted him to have a holy line. And he's blessing and making this oath before the Lord because he wants the Lord to be involved in this. Now, why did he need to find a wife from among his people and not from among the Canaanites? The answer is ultimately that he had some questions about the character of the people of Canaan. But it's interesting because if you were with us in studying in the Gospel Project this morning, or you know the story of Abraham, the land that Abraham came from, what was true of the people that lived there? They were pagans. So wait a minute, right? You're like, okay, don't marry Canaanite because, you know, we find that to be the case in all of Israel's history. Whenever they marry the Canaanites, their hearts are led astray, right? They're led into idol worship. So he says, why don't you take my servant, why don't you go back to the land that I grew up in and find a wife for him there? But from what you and I know, what's true of Abraham's home people, right, is they're pagans too. So what's the difference? What's the difference? Right? Well, a couple of things. Rebecca's father, his name is Bethuel, and he gets mentioned before, he just gets mentioned in passing in a genealogy, and he gets mentioned again a little bit later in this chapter, but it's very, very interesting because his name sounds very much familiar, like a town that you've probably heard in the scriptures before, Bethel. His name's Bethuel. His name means this, man of God. Isn't that interesting? Here's what I think happened. I think Abraham knew this, and this is why he ultimately wanted to do this. What Abraham knew was that his family had undergone some spiritual change over the course of time, so much so that his nephew is now literally a name of man and who's called a man of God. And when you get to the very end of Genesis chapter 24, you'll find that both Laban and Bethuel refer to the Lord by his covenant name, capital L-O-R-D, or Yahweh, or Jehovah. They call him by the covenant name. That is, they know him and they are in relationship with him, right? They're not just saying he's a god of the Canaanites or a god of the nations. They call him by his specific covenant-keeping name. So here you have a man of God in his household who call upon the name of the Lord. Something happened. We don't know what happened. But Abraham knew. And he knew that the people that he came from, God had done a work to work within their hearts, that they would start calling upon the name of the Lord. When you read about the rest of the account, we'll find out that that Laban and Bethuel, they didn't speak in the name of God. They didn't speak in the names of some lord of the area. They used the covenant-keeping name of God. And they seek to bless the servant that Abraham sends. And ultimately, they refuse to stand in the way of the Lord. They know him. They respect him. They have his name literally as a part of their lives. I mean, whatever happened, we don't know. We'll find out in heaven someday. Abraham knew that the people that he came from, God had transformed. And that's why he sent his servant back to them, to find one who was godly from the people that he had gone. It's interesting, you know, we often say, like, what will happen to our family if we walk in obedience with the Lord? A lot of times God uses our testimony and our example to actually be something that is a good example to our family members, and they actually get saved in the process. It's amazing how God can work these things out. Likewise, he also wanted to make sure that Isaac never went back to the land of his ancestors because he didn't want Isaac to drift away from what God had promised. That's the other thing we just made mention of as we read through here, is that Abraham was really concerned that if Isaac went back to the land of his ancestors, he'd be like, well, hey, all my family's here. Why don't I just stay here? Like, I just got a new wife from my ancestors. They got a place to live. And Abraham was really, really concerned that his son would receive the promise that God had made. So he's like, two things, right? Don't get a Canaanite wife for my son, and don't you dare take him back. I want him here, and I want him married to a faithful woman. And this is the instructions that he gives to this servant. He was a good father trying to make sure his son found a good bride, and he did not want to take him away from the blessings of God by making marriage something that would remove him from that. This is really a direct result of Abraham's 60 plus years now of walking with the Lord. You know, from all that we know, Abraham didn't have any laws of God written down. Right? No Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. None of that stuff was written down for him that we have any awareness of. But what is very, very clear is that Abraham was so close to the heart of God. He walked in such close friendship with God that he was making wise decisions and he was acting in right relationship to God because of what God had revealed. This is a man of faith who doesn't have to have everything written down to say this is exactly what he must do, because in his heart he knew God and had been walking with him for so long that he was able to do this. He knew God's agenda because God's agenda had become his agenda. And so he was so concerned about his son getting married, but he was also so concerned about God's plan coming to forth that he was making sure, as much as was humanly possible on his part, that he would be part of God's plan coming to pass. You might say it this way: Abraham abided in God. Kind of like we've been talking about in John a little bit, right? Jesus abides in us and we abide in him, so that his life is our life, and so that his agenda is our agenda, and so that as he works in us, we display that to the whole entire world. That's Abraham, what he's really doing, right? He is so entrenched, so enamored, so connected with the plan of God that when he's thinking about, okay, how do I get my son married off? Okay, he's got to stay in the land because that's God's plan. He's got to marry a godly woman because that's part of God's plan. He's so committed to God because he knows him so . Second thing we see here is this servant's godly character. The main character, apart from God, in this chapter actually is the servant. Okay? If you read the whole chapter, I won't because it's like 67 verses long. Okay? You'll find out that the main character is actually the servant. He does almost all of the talking. He's the one who travels. He's the one who does the bargaining. He's the one who gives gifts. He's the one who brings home the bride for Isaac. In fact, Abraham only speaks at the beginning. Bethuel speaks only once. And Isaac never even says a word. Who does all the talking? Servant. Who does all the acting? I don't mean like pretending. I mean, who's the one who takes out all the action, right? It's the servant. So who is this old servant? It's very, very possible that it's Eliezer of Damascus. Remember, before Isaac was born, Abraham was like, God, what are you going to give me? I need a son. And he's like, all I've got is Eliezer of Damascus. He wasn't even born in my house. Is he going to be my heir? And God's like, no, Isaac's going to be your heir. Remember that? Right? It's very possible this is Eliezer of Damascus. It may or may not be, I don't know, but I like to think that it is, because he's been walking with Abraham now for all of these years, learning from him, and he trusted Eliezer to this point. Text makes clear that this is the oldest and most trusted servant of Abraham, and it's very, very clear that he is a godly man. Let me show you a couple of examples as to how we know this is a godly man. Look down at verse 11 of chapter 24. The servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed from all of his master's goods were in hand, and he rose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor, and he made his camels kneel down outside the city by a well of water evening time. Then the women went to go out to water, and he said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, please give me success this day and show kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, here I stand by the well of water. The daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now let it be that the young woman whom I say, please let down your pitcher that I may drink, that she says, drink, and I will also give your camels a drink. Let her be the one who you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. What does he do first when he gets to the well? Praise. Right? He prays. And it's kind of interesting, his camels kneel, right? I kind of have to chuckle to that about myself. Are the camels praying? I don't think so, but right? But the first thing he does when he arrives at this well is he starts to see the ladies coming out to draw the water. The first thing he does is he brings this before the Lord and asks the Lord for direction, asks the Lord for success. This man, his first avenue, who is carrying out this vital mission of his master, is to pray. The first thing he wants. He himself has a relationship with God. He's not just simply carrying out Abraham's wishes. Obviously, he's acting on behalf of Abraham, but what in his own heart, what he really believes is that God is the one who's going to give success on this day. And so he asks God for this. The second thing we see here is that he watches with wonder when he sees God work. Look at verse 21. This woman comes and says, "Here, I'll give you a drink and I'll give water to your camels." In verse 21, "And the man, wondering at her, remained silent so as to know whether the Lord had made this journey prosperous or not." He's standing there going, "I can't believe it. God did it." Wondering, right? He has this wonder in him. Yes, I know, mean wondering can also mean thinking, right? But it's both. It's both and. Right, where he's pondering and he's also marveling at what God is going to do. And when God answers his prayer, look at verse 26 and 27. This woman is definitely the one. She's from his from the family of Abraham. And the man bowed his head, verse 26, and he worshiped the Lord. And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me, being on the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brethren." What does this guy do when God answers prayer? Hallelujah! Right? He just has to stop and worship him right here. Has to, because God has done this. God has not forsaken his mercy. God has not forsaken his truth. He was the one who led him in all of the possibilities and all of the land. He led him right to a daughter of his master's family. And he gives God the glory for this. Verses 34 through 38, I won't read them for you, but he, in giving an account of how this all unfolds, he speaks openly about how God was the one who was involved. He gives God the glory, he gives God the credit, he worships him, and he wants everybody to know God is the one who is working here. After Bethuel and Laban tried to stall for a bit of time, and he says, "I can't do this," what happens in verse 52 is, "When Abraham's servant heard their words, he worshiped the Lord, bowing himself to the earth." When they said, "All right, we're not going to delay you any longer. We're going to let you go." What does he do again? He bows down and worships. This is a man who's full of love and fervor for God. He's an unnamed servant, but he has this great testimony. And verse 56 says here, he offers this statement to them. He said, "Do not hinder me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I can go to my master." He wants them to know that God is moving and he's following God. This man shows about a testimony of a life spent in prayer and faith and worship. He's quick to pray. He's quick to follow the leading of God. He's quick to openly give credit to the life of God. And I say, I mean, if you're looking for an example of someone to emulate your life after, a human person apart from Christ, this man, even though he has no name, is a wonderful example of what faith looks like. Bathing everything in prayer, worshiping God at the deliverance that he gives to you, constantly keeping things before the Lord and letting God lead and God work. This is what this man does. Now, many of you in this room tonight are married. And I want to talk here for just a couple minutes here about this marriage as it unfolds. Has anyone here had an arranged marriage? I didn't think so. But I was like, hey, you never know. I don't know all of you that well. But I thought, you never know. Somebody maybe had an arranged marriage. How many of you would like to have an arranged marriage? I don't think anybody really would, honestly, right? Did anybody want your parents arranging a marriage for you? So one of the things we read about in this account is that Abraham sends out a servant to find a wife for Isaac. It's an arranged marriage, right? And to us in our Western sensibilities here, that seems like the craziest thing ever. Like, who in the world would do such a thing? And it's not been that long, really, in our world where arranged marriages weren't the norm. We're kind of oddballs, honestly. Okay, but there is a lot to be learned here from a suitable marriage, even if the whole idea of an arranged marriage seems offensive to you, or if you're like, no, I don't want to be the one who gets set up with anybody, right? There are a lot of things actually to gather here from what makes for a suitable marriage, and I've put five of them up here on the screen that will show up one by one here, but a couple of things I want you to see here. First of all, a suitable marriage requires that a couple be equally yoked. Abraham set this principle in motion when he sent his servant to look for a specific lady from a specific group of people because he knew there were certain core values that were essential to make a marriage be honoring to God, right? It couldn't just be any old woman. It couldn't just be any old person from any old place. He knew that what his son really needed and what his family really needed was a husband and a wife matched together that were yoked together in their love for God. And that's true no matter whether we're talking arranged marriages or our way of doing marriage here in our world, right? If you have two people that are not yoked together, both in the desires of their heart and their love for God, you're going to have all kinds of trouble. Right? The idea of being equally yoked is used in terms of a lot of different ways in scriptures, but you can imagine the visual picture of it, okay? You've got two oxen and a yoke, and they're both trying to go opposite directions. How profitable are they going to be? How much hardship and pain is there going to be along the way? Right? This is the idea here that is given. He wants a godly woman for his son. There is potential for such unspeakable sorrow and strife if you simply say, I've got love and that's all that I need. There are things that you need to think about in terms of a marriage being yoked together in the right way. A second thing we see here is that a suitable marriage requires fervent prayer. Requires fervent prayer. Talk about a scary decision, right? I mean, you really don't honestly know what you're marrying, right? Right? I mean, you think you know. You date for a little bit of time, right? And you see all the best of that person. You don't see any of their flaws, right? And you're engaged for a period of time, and you see all the best of that person. You don't see any of their flaws. And then you marry them, and you're like, what did I do? Right? Right? I can't believe how they eat. I can't believe how they snore, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things that you're like, you really honestly don't know, right? You get an idea, but you're kind of stepping out in faith, aren't you? A lot of you have been married here a lot longer than I have. You know that you know to some degree what you're getting, but you have no idea what that life will look like. And you don't even know, honestly, how your spouse will respond to God's direction in their life as the time goes on. Sometimes the spouse who begins strong in their love for God just ultimately throws off who the Lord is and they decide to walk in their own ways. And how can you predict that from the beginning? Right? It's a really a very real thing in our life. And this is why in this situation and also in our situations today that fervent prayer before dating, during engagement needs to be a part of your relationship. And not just your prayer because you see the best in a person, but prayers of people around you, right? Your parents, your siblings, all different kinds of people around you. Fervent prayer needs to be one of those things because you need God to lead you and God to direct you because you're making a decision that's going to ultimately direct the rest of your life one way or the other. And you see that all over the place here, from Abraham's prayers to the servant's prayers to everything that happens in this whole account is, God, please make it clear. God, direct. God, give the blessing. God, make all of our paths straight. And that needs to be the prayer of those that are seeking marriage. It needs to be a prayer of parents that have children of marrying age. It needs to be a prayers of grandparents and great-grandparents for your kids. It has to be bathed in prayer. God's direction is the thing that needs to lead relationships. The third thing you see here is that a suitable marriage is often evidenced by God's clear hand of providence. By God's clear hand of providence, right? I mean, the servant walks up to the well, and there's all these women coming. And the one that says, can I get you a drink of water? Sure. Can I get your camels a drink of water? Sure. That's the one. Is that providential or chance? Of course it's providential, right? God was working here. There is a hand of God's providence ultimately involved in this. God heard the prayer of the servant. He knew the heart and the prayer of Abraham. And in the actual moment in which it took place, the hand of God made clear what was to take place. The hand of God was clearly at work. And I'm not saying here that God is going to put like a big shining billboard over the one person you're supposed to marry. Right? Or that somehow you're gonna go to the local watering hole and the person who comes up and says, hey, I'd like a Coke, that's the person you're gonna marry. I'm not saying that's how it's gonna go. Right? But it is very clear that God's hand of providence directs you. I feel that way often whenever I think about my college experience. I really, 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 really wanted to go to Moody. And I had every reason theoretically to get into Moody, and I got denied 3 times to Moody. So I was like, well, I went to my second choice, and wouldn't you know it, I met my wife. Right? And even more than that, we got put together in a small group was the first place we met because the teachers divided up the class without knowing people. And pff, there you are. Right? It didn't always go right at first because she thought I was scary. And I had to convince her that I wasn't. But it was God's hand of providence that not only directed me out to Clark Summit, but also God's hand of providence that directed her there. And also the God's hand of providence directed how it is that we even met in the first place. Right? I mean, you have to say that. And it's not like she was the only person on the planet I could have married, but God was leading both of our lives together. And this was evident. And this is evident in a lot of your stories if we were to talk about them today. And this is one of those ways that God answers prayer, by directing our lives and guiding our steps, willing to walk with him. A fourth thing we see here is that family is involved from the very beginning. Family is involved from the very beginning, right? I know some of you have strong feelings about how embarrassing your family may be to you. But parents and siblings and your family should be involved in the dating engagement process, right? They are a part of your family. You should get to know their family. They should get to know your family. My dad always told me growing up, if you're too embarrassed to bring a girl home, you better just dump her right now. And I was like, why? And I realized as time went on, the reason was because if you're too embarrassed to bring her home, then what in the world are you doing thinking about dating her in the first place? If you can't involve her in your family life, if you can't be involved in her family life, there are some real dangers. If it's just you and you alone, solo dating all the time, you're on an island to yourself, there is real danger in that. Abraham initiates the marriage process. This was a family affair all along. Now, I'm not saying we have to go back to arranged marriages. That's not what I'm saying. But family definitely needs to be involved because you marry into a family. And they marry into your family, whether you like it or not, right? That's the way that it works. You have all gone through those struggles where you know you're taking two families and you are bringing them together in a lot of different ways. Family needs to be involved from the very beginning. And that's actually one of the ways that God uses family to be a protection for young men and young women that are seeking marriage. Where God says, by giving us the family, your parents have some advice maybe that you ought to listen to sometimes. Or parents, you have advice that you ought to give sometimes. Or grandparents, maybe you should be willing to speak openly. Because sometimes you see your kids, your grandkids walking in relationships that are not suitable and not good. And God uses family sometimes to be the means by saying, maybe you ought to think twice about that. Because you see things that they don't see because they're just gaga, right? God can use family in this way. Another thing we see lastly here, fifthly, about a pseudo marriage is it's supposed to be a great blessing and a comfort. Great blessing and a comfort. All of this happens shortly after the death of Sarah. And I really feel for her, okay? She never saw her son get married off. She never got to meet any of her grandkids, okay? But one of the things that is said here at the very end of this chapter is Isaac was brought, verse 67, to his mother's tent and took Rebekah and she became his wife and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. There was a blessing that was brought about. The end of one life ultimately initiated the beginning of this new marriage relationship. And it was not only a blessing to Isaac, but it was also a comfort to him, where he had always had his mother in his life, but now God has knit him together where the two become one flesh and they can leave their father and mother and become one. It was a blessing and a comfort to him. Don't ever let the world tell you that marriage is not a blessing. We have a lot of work to do as Christians to speaking truth about what God made marriage to be. Right? The world has all kinds of ideas about what it's supposed to be, and some of the wrong opinions of the world have been propagated and continued by people like us. Marriage is a blessing. Marriage is a gift. Marriage is good. Right? It's not something that you complain about. It's not something that we whine about. It's not something that we speak openly and negatively about to all kinds of people. Well, young man, young woman, just wait till you get married. It'll all be over then. Christians talk that way. It's a blessing, whether you believe that or not. God made it to be so. Think about marriage. Is it punishment? No. It was made before there was ever sin in the world. It was a perfect creation of God. Yes, it's been marred by sin, but it is one of those things that is left that is here from the very beginning that God made when he said it's very good. We need to continue speaking good about what marriage is and what marriage can be. Marriage is a blessing because God made it to be so. Now, two last closing snapshots from this family come in chapter 25. Abraham gets remarried. Chapter 25, verse 1, he marries this woman named Keturah, and she gives birth to six sons that are made mention here, and there's a couple of grandchildren that are mentioned here as well. Verse 5, though, says this: Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had while he was still living, and he sent them eastward away from Isaac his son and to the country of the east. Now, again, this is not necessarily like, good job, Abraham, you've got concubines, right? But one of the things that you just have to see here that's really amazing is God said to Abraham, this old man who couldn't have children, I'm going to make you a great nation. Right? And he had Ishmael. Did he have Ishmael in the right way? He didn't. Ishmael became the father of 12 nations. 12 princes became Ishmael's sons. And you've got a whole entire part of the world population now that came from Ishmael. Right? He marries Keturah. And she has 6 sons, and a few of the grandsons are made mention here, and they go to the east. And who do all of these people descend from? From Abraham. And then you're going to have Isaac, who's going to take center stage in the rest of the book of Genesis and his descendants, and they are going to dwell in Canaan. And who's going to fill the land of Canaan? So now you've got Abraham's descendants where? You've got many of them to the south, you've got many of them to the east, and many of them right in the land that God had promised. You start to see here how God is fulfilling his promise, even through Abraham's unfaithfulness in some accounts. He's filling the land, he's filling the earth, he's filling the nations, and he's using the descendants of Abraham to be a blessing to the nations. And you see this happening even here. There is one chosen line that comes through Isaac, but Abraham's family tree is growing like crazy. Here we see God keeping his promise to Abraham. The last thing that we see here is in verse 7 and following, and that is when Abraham dies. He lived 175 years. He breathed his last and died a good old age, an old man full of years, and he was gathered to his people. His sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittites, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Het. There Abraham was buried, and Sarah his wife. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham, God blessed his son, and Isaac dwelt at Beer Lahai Roi. Abraham lived a good long life. He was buried with his wife, and he was buried by his two boys that he loved the most. He loved Ishmael, even though Ishmael had gone out because at the Lord's direction. He loved Isaac. The two of them came back together, and you see here, it doesn't seem to be that there's even any animosity. They joined together to bury their father with their mother. One of the interesting things here about this is if you do all the math and you line everything up and look at forward at chapter, the rest of 25 and into chapter 26, you find out that probably Abraham was alive for the first 15 years of Jacob and Esau's life too. Do the math and how it all lines up. So he actually got to see and spend some time with his grandsons. Again, my heart breaks for Sarah because she didn't get to. But Abraham got to see Isaac have his boys. And here comes the end of Abraham's life. And he is gathered to his people, which was a statement that is repeated in Genesis for those that die faithfully. They're gathered to their people. Same thing that's going to be used to describe Ishmael at the end of his life. Same thing that's going to be described to Isaac at the end of his life. The same thing's going to be described to describe Jacob at the end of his life. They'll be gathered to their people. It's a way of saying they are gathered together with those that have gone before them that are faithful and have passed on. I always think it's interesting to remember that we kind of look at Ishmael as this cast off somewhere, but he ends up in the same place, his soul, that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob did. A testimony about what was going on in the heart of Isaac. This brings to an end then his life. He has died, he's buried with his wife, and the Lord has blessed him. And the rest of the scriptures, in a sense, is unfolding as to how God is going to continue to fulfill his promise to Abraham. Now he's going to bless us through Abraham's seed, which if you were here this morning, you probably heard if you were in one of the Gospel Project classes that the seed is not the seeds like the kids of Abraham. It is the seed, singular, and that's Jesus. Abraham then becomes the father of all of these branches of physical life, but he also becomes the direct pathway for us to know his seed, Jesus. And through his seed, Jesus, the world really is blessed. You and I are sitting here today as testimonies of that, aren't we? We've been blessed because of God's work in Abraham, an imperfect man, a sinful man at times, right? A man who operated outside of God's designs on a number of different occasions, but ultimately a man of faith who loved God and who believed God and is an evidence of God's grace because God chose him and God blessed him despite Abraham's failings. And if there's hope for Abraham, it means there's hope for us, right? We can be blessed in God too, because God works with imperfect people. God works with those that have checkered backgrounds. God works with those that sometimes work outside of his plans because he is always faithful to his covenant and to his promises. That's why we can be delighted to serve the Lord our God, because he is faithful even when we are not. And that's just as true in Abraham's life as it is in our own. God, we thank you for your goodness to us, specifically in Christ Jesus. We thank you for the account of Abraham's life. And Lord, there's much to be gleaned that we didn't cover. And so I pray that you would lay it upon the hearts of people here to go back and to look carefully and see what else is here that they might grow from it. But God, I pray that you'd help us, if nothing else tonight, to walk away with this idea that you are good and that you keep your promises and that you are faithful to your covenants and that you will establish the work of your hands here on this earth. Whatever you promise to do, you are capable of doing. There is nothing impossible for you, even when it seems humanly like there's no way. God, we praise you for the gifts that you give to us in Christ Jesus. We thank you for the gift of marriage. We thank you for the gift of family. We thank you for the gift that you've given us of life and breath in this world. We pray that you would help us to live in the blessings you've created for us, and that we would know that you are God, and that we would know that you create us and you bless us, and that we would give all the glory and all the honor to you, to who it belongs. Father, we pray this in your holy name.